Welcome to Season 3 of Inflammation Nation. My name is Gráinne O'Leary. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. You're very welcome to today's episode on menopause and arthritis. I'm joined today by Dr. Deirdre Lungey, who's the head of Ireland's first public menopause clinic in the National Maternity Hospital. She's accredited by the British Menopause Society and trains doctors in women's healthcare for the Irish College of General Practitioners. Deirdre is also the author of The Menopause, The Essential Guide to Managing Your Health in Midlife. Also joined by Mary Gillespie, who is a registered rheumatology advanced nurse practitioner and has been a member of the Irish Rheumatology Nurse Forum since 2013 and was appointed chairperson in 2022. Mary has worked in the rheumatology department at the University Hospital Limerick Group and is based at Nina Hospital, County Tipperary, for the last 12 years. Ladies, you're very welcome today and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start off, Deirdre, with the first question to yourself, which is, you know, look, we hear a lot about women experiencing the onset of arthritis with perimenopause and menopause. Is there an established link between menopause and the onset of arthritis?
It's very hard to give a simple answer to that question. It's a very loaded question because, as you know, there's lots of arthritises. They're not all the same. So it kind of depends on which one you're talking about. Okay. Some people, there's data to support the fact that some people get a bit of a break after the menopause from certain types of arthritic conditions, whereas other women will find that the first onset of their symptoms come at the time of the perimenopause or after their final menstrual period. So, and then each woman, there's a lot of inter-patient variation. So sadly, there is no hard and fast rule about what menopause and perimenopause might do to you, whether or not it'll worsen a pre-existing arthritic condition, whether or not it'll improve in some cases, or whether you start to get symptoms for the first time ever. We just don't know. We don't know. I mean, there are some generalities. There are people who experience more flares, particularly with SLE. You tend to get more flares around the perimenopause. But, and then there are women who don't have any actual diagnosis, who come to us with musculoskeletal complaints, and now they're wondering, have I got something going on? I've never had joint pain before. Now, all of a sudden, I can barely get out of the bed in the morning. What is going on? And that would be very typical of the perimenopause for some people, particularly people whose menopausal status has been kind of made happen artificially, like, say, with breast cancer treatments or after having oophorectomy for a variety of different reasons. So it's a real mixed bag. And we don't really approach it with any hard and fast rules. We take each patient as an individual as she comes to us.
I guess more research.
We don't have it.
Yeah. Mary, there are many symptoms that are associated with arthritis and menopause that seem to overlap, you know, such as sleep disruption, fatigue. Is it possible that they're potentially both connected to menopause and arthritis and not one or the other?
Yeah, well, I'd echo Dr. Lundy about research and not having much evidence out there for our patients at present, and there's a lot more to do. But there's most definitely menopause itself doesn't directly cause arthritis, but it can contribute to joint pain and symptoms. And some patients or some women may experience joint pain and stiffness or inflammation during the menopause, and this can sometimes mimic arthritis symptoms. So I suppose it's essential between your menopause symptoms and an underlying condition that you speak to your primary care physician. And if you are already a patient of the rheumatology service, that you speak to either your rheumatology team, be it the nurses or the medical team, and look at the appropriate care that we need to and interventions that may need to come. Another cohort of patients we come across are patients with chronic pain syndrome, such as fibromyalgia, and a lot of people out there who experience this symptom and then have menopause on top of it. It's very difficult. The water has become muddied, I would say. And that's where a good conversation piece and a good assessment history. And there may be even a time to have a chat with your GP about even to go on a course of HRT to see does it alleviate those symptoms so that we can try and unmuddy the waters, if you like.
Okay. Yeah.
back to you, Deirdre. Yeah. You know, we know that women going through perimenopause and menopause experience a drop in estrogen levels.
Well, in perimenopause, it's not a drop. In fact, some days you can have massive amounts.
Okay.
So in perimenopause, it's wild fluctuations of sex hormone. And after your final menstrual period, typically it's reduction in sex hormone. And it's funny because the impact on pain and arthritic conditions can be different depending on which phase you're in.
Right, yeah. Okay. So, you know, can reduced estrogen increase inflammation levels? You know, and will, you know, taking HRT, would that possibly have an impact on inflammation? Help
yes,
to manage
yes
it?
And no.
Yeah,
so
okay.
So estrogen has anti-inflammatory properties, but it also has pro-inflammatory properties.
Okay, okay.
So, and it depends on what type of estrogen we're talking about, how you're delivering it to the systemic circulation, to the bloodstream, what kind of progestogen you're using to counterbalance that additive treatment, because you're not allowed to use estrogen on its own. If you have a womb, you must also use progestogen. Mm. So now what's that progestogen going to do to the inflammatory process? Mm. And what about the fact that sleep disruption and mood alteration has such an impact on arthritic conditions, and is the benefit you might get from hormone supplementation or balancing directly on the inflammatory process, or is it giving you an amelioration of your sleep disruption and your mood issues? You know what I mean? Mm. So it's there's a lot of moving parts.
Yes, very hard to unpick.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe my next question is redundant, but is there, in your experience, any connection between women that experience early menopause and inflammatory arthritis?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I don't know about inflammatory arthritis, but certainly musculoskeletal in general, it's huge. Mm. 80% of the ladies we accept in our clinic are breast cancer patients, people who've been diagnosed with breast cancer.
Okay.
And a significant number of them will have been on anti-hormone therapies so as to suppress estrogen availability to the receptors in their cancer cells. And sometimes the impact on their musculoskeletal system is horrendous. These are fit, active women who've had a little lumpectomy, maybe some chemo, maybe some radiotherapy, but now their aromatase inhibitor has made them feel like a little old lady, that they can't move in the house, that, you know, they can't do exercise, they can't live the life they once had, and you'd wonder, what the heck is going on? Have I traded in one illness for another?
Sure.
Yeah. So for them, life is quite difficult, and of course, being diagnosed with a hormone receptive tumor means that our choices around HRT are far more rocky. Yeah. So, yeah, I definitely noticed the younger you are when your hormone levels are reduced, especially if that happens dramatically with medicines or surgery or as a result of like radiotherapy for other diseases, the impact of musculoskeletal deterioration tends to be much worse, tends to be. Other people, no impact. So a lot of it depends on what your own genetic pregame was like.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Deirdre, there's obviously, you know, many different types of arthritis and indeed rheumatic diseases. Can I ask you a little bit about a diagnosis of lupus and how that might be treated
that's
your work?
That's a really good question, because in fact, that's the only cohort I typically see in Hollis Street.
Right.
We have very strict referral criteria. Cancers, reproductive cancers would be number one, cardiovascular disease number two, certain immunological conditions, but definitely people who have rheumatic conditions that may affect their propensity towards blood clots, or people who've had a thrombosis or an embolism, we would see a lot of those patients. Mm-hmm. And in general, our attitude towards HRT is very positive. So we know that oral estrogen, whether it's the contraceptive pill with its potent artificial estrogens, or oral HRT tablets, estrogen taken orally can promote clotting factors and you can precipitate a blood clot. So any woman who's got antiphospholipids or has had a previous DVT or even a strong family history should probably not take oral estrogen. But that doesn't mean they can't have HRT. It just means that the estrogen has to be delivered in low doses through the skin. And we have an abundance of data to suggest that if you give HRT as a patch, a gel, or a spray, very, very judiciously, starting low and titrating up within reason, mm-hmm. you don't add to that lady's clot burden. Now, if she's already a high risk for clot lady, she's a high risk for clot lady. So, and events happen. So she needs to be, we need to talk about that. But we would never automatically look towards alternatives to HRT for women with SLE, with antiphospholipids. We would happily prescribe HRT for them as if that's what they wanted and if that's what they felt if that's what we felt would help them. And it's funny because they've often gotten the exact opposite advice from the rheumatologist. Mm. So that puts a woman in a really an enviable position where one specialist is saying, oh, no, you never want to take that HRT stuff because you and your blood clots. And then another specialist is saying, oh, no, no, it's perfectly all right. Like, who do you believe and how do you go home with confidence to try these products? So, and I think you've had experience of that, Mary, as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just an area looking, as we say, you're the data now, it's trying to get that data, but it's the way the hormone is given, that the options weren't there historically. Doing it through the patch or the spray with the low dose may be the way forward. And it is a point of conversation again with your rheumatologist and with your primary care.
Absolutely. We've just recently got Thrombosis Ireland to actually change their product leaf, their website and their handouts to say that, to be clear, low-dose, non-oral HRT products do not increase your risk of blood clot, and you can use them if you want. So if Thrombosis Ireland and Thrombosis UK are happy to promote the use of HRT for women with pre-existing clotting disorder or risk, then who are we, you know, like I'm delighted. But I don't know that everybody's on the same page about that.
Sure. Are there times, particular diagnoses, where HRT may not be or cannot be used? And then what are those potential alternatives
the
to
largest
those symptoms?
Yeah, the largest cohort of women we meet where HRT is absolutely the last thing that would be on the table would be people with hormone-sensitive malignancies like breast cancer, certain types of ovarian cancer, not all of them. Some ovarian cancers are not hormone-driven. So for those women, and we have a list, you know, we have the big Professor Brennan's big book of cancers that tells us green light, red light, amber light, you know, that kind of a thing. So for the breast cancer ladies, when we meet them, sadly, the only form of perimenopause and menopause care that kind of improves all the symptoms across the board is HRT.
Right.
So what happens is when we see somebody who's got super contraindication to estrogen, like a woman with ER-positive breast cancer, we say, okay, tell me your top three problems. What are the three things that if you could get balance and improvement from, your life would be better? And we individually go for them. So for a lot of people, it's mood. And we might move in there with some cognitive behavior therapy, with a little bit of mood medication, exercise, sleep hygiene, that kind of a thing. Some people will say, oh, it's these flushes and sweats. Mm-hmm. And there are emerging therapies now. We're about to have one in about 2 months that just targets flushes and sweats. It's an oral tablet called Veoza with a V. And wonderful preliminary data coming back about that. And we may well be using that amongst breast cancer survivors. But when it comes to aches and pains and joint aches and musculoskeletal symptoms and fatigue, which is always a big part of rheumatological diseases, we look mostly at things like stuff like neuropathic pain drugs that can help. Definitely sleep is the core to well-being. So trying to intervene with sleep. We recently started, for people who are not sensitive to them, we've been using low-dose over-the-counter antihistamines, like you'd give Calpol to a kid with a head cold and they get a little nap going. A lot of women say, I do get off to sleep. I go to bed exhausted. I sleep for about 3 hours and then, bing, I'm wide awake. We suggest they take maybe a couple of milligrams of Phenergan at that point to kind of make them semi-drowsy again and maybe induce a recovery. So now, none of this stuff is trialed. In menopausal women, it's all off-label use of stuff we already have for other things that we're trying to make life a little bit better for our ladies.
Because a lot of the population out there in rheumatology patients will be familiar with amitriptyline as the drug of choice to try and induce a sleep pattern. But a lot of people don't like it because they
find it works for some.
Yeah, exactly.
But not everybody.
Yeah, and I think that's the word of the day. We are all such individuals and every conversation is an individual and every treatment is and response to is individual.
We don't really use a lot of amitriptyline, although, like you say, some people, like, you can get really good response. some people not so much, mm-hmm. and other people don't like it at all. We cautiously use a little gabapentin for people with joint pain, and where it seems to be useful in is in people who don't have an underlying arthritic condition, but for people who got musculoskeletal disorder from their anti-estrogen therapy. Yes. So a lot of ladies on letrozole will come crippling in with really severe knee and leg pain. And for them, even tiny sub-therapeutic doses of gabapentin can help. Like the British Menopause Society recommends 300 milligrams three times a day of gabapentin for somebody with joint pain. I mean, I would be a zombie on that. Most of my ladies would be. We say, why don't you take a half a hundred or 100 at bedtime and see if you can wake up in the morning, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you do and you can tolerate it, maybe that'll help your joint pain.
Okay, good advice. Thank you.
Mary, in terms of lifestyle and diet, look, they can play a huge role in managing both menopausal and arthritis symptoms. We know that. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what can we do to help ourselves?
Well, absolutely. Lifestyle and diet, we sing it every day in clinic, can significantly impact on the management of menopausal and arthritis symptoms. So both. And for menopause, I suppose it's maintaining a balanced diet. It's looking at regular exercise. It's managing stress to help promote sleep. So it's all those things, which in turn is helpful for arthritis. Mm. I suppose with a lot of patients will ask us about anti-inflammatory diets, you know, with arthritis. Mm. And we talk about the Mediterranean diet, and but we talk about balance and we talk about moderation. And there's the modifiables that we have that we talk about, and smoking, which is causes inflammation in the body. You know, all these impact both on arthritis, but also on menopause. So there's the other side of the smoking side of it is that we try to guide our patients towards the HSE support. It's very good online. And yes, sometimes we meet patients coming into clinic and they may have been given a diagnosis, a new diagnosis that day, and then we're harping on about lifestyle and we're harping on. So it's we're sometimes, and I appreciate Arthritis Ireland are very supportive to us for our patients, so that we give them that information on the day about their disease, and then they can come back and connect with you guys to maybe get more chat about diet and smoking and support with that. So it's kind of breaking that down. But I suppose, and the other side of it all is cardiac health is a big thing. So menopause contributes to cardiac health as well and causing problems there. So you've got this mixed bag now of being a woman, being menopausal, and having a chronic disease such as, we'll take an example of rheumatoid arthritis. So all those factors, we need to look at the things that we can change and that we can address and get support with that. And it does make a difference, and we've seen it make a difference.
Deirdre, in terms of, you know, we know the weight around our abdomen, our middle, you know, is dangerous for our health and can bring an increased risk of, you know, diabetes, cancer and heart conditions. We also know the cardiovascular disease becomes a higher risk when estrogen levels fall. Hope I have that correct.
Yeah.
Is it inevitable for women that weight gain comes with menopause?
Well, a lot of it depends on what your own metabolic ability was prior, you know, heretofore. But in general, yes, unfortunately, optimal estrogen kind of patterns, like you see during people who are still menstruating, generally improve the behavior of the basal metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. So people burn more calories when their estrogen is behaving properly. And as estrogen levels start to fluctuate and then eventually drop, we notice a diminution in basal metabolic rate. As a result, you don't burn calories the way you once did. And on average, women between their 45th and their 55th birthdays will gain 1 to 2 stone. And that's assuming they don't change their calorie intake. Mm. I mean, exercise has a role without question, but it's predominantly about the stuff you put in your mouth, you know. Mm. So, and we're only now getting emerging help for people with chronic overweight obesity who, through no fault of their own, have struggled maybe a lifetime and trying to get inside of our optimal BMI range that we're always harping on about, and particularly important for people who have, you know, lower body joint issues, that they keep their weight as optimal as possible. easier said than done when you can't sleep. Mm. You're exhausted all the time. You're getting hot flushes that are disrupting your sleep. So your energy in the day is shot to hell. You've got chronic fatigue as a result of it. And now someone says, oh, you have to go, you know, do your 10,000 steps. Like all you need, all you have the energy for is turn it on Netflix and open in a bag of something, you know. Like what Mary was saying, moderation, I think not being overly critical of yourself, doing the best you can at this point in time and being aware is more important than being superwoman and ticking every box within 2 weeks of advice. I think that's the key, you know. I'll do what I can when I can do it. And if using some kind of hormone supportive therapy gives you a leg up towards that goal, that's what we're here for. That's what your GP is there for.
Okay. Mary, when it comes to extra weight gain and arthritis, you know, it can put extra strain on the joints, you know, making mobility more difficult. And, you know, it, that can lead to osteoarthritis in some instances, you know, particularly if there's a family history of arthritis. How do we break this cycle? And, you know, do we need to educate women at a younger age to be aware of these risks?
Yeah, I'm pretty passionate about this thing of educating people, and knowledge is power. And I do find, like, women's health and women's reproductive health starts at puberty, then we have fertility, and the end game is menopause. Mm. So it's not an extra, it's part of the woman's journey in her fertility. Mm. So I just think there's, like, in our primary schools, we've got a fantastic education about puberty and how to, you know, manage the change in a young adolescent's body, etc. But there just seems to be that gap then. We move into secondary school and you've got young women entering into the world. We're talking about breast check, breast cancer. Mm. We're, you know, they should be familiar. It should be part of just, you know, putting on your makeup, brushing your hair. It should be part of it, and they shouldn't have to think too much about it. And it should be promoted in a healthy way. Mm. Not that you're looking for something, but you're trying to be aware, be aware of your body. So it's the same when it comes to weight and that. Because a lot of our young generation now, they're fantastic with their understanding of the macros in the diet. I mean, I didn't know what that word was for a long time. So, but they need all the other little bits of information too. It's not about going to the gym and the protein that you eat and things like that. It's about knowing what's ahead of you as a woman, we'll say, for example, because we're talking about menopause here today. But when it comes to osteoarthritis, I often say to patients, you know, if you lose 1 pound of weight, and people are often very dismissive about losing one or two, you lose 4 pounds of pressure off your knees. Yeah. So if you lose 2 pounds, that's half a stone gone off your knees, and it makes a difference. You will notice a difference. So I just think small things should be recognised and championed. And, you know, if you make 1% of a change in a day, that leads to changes further down the line. So you don't have to do a big, huge change. Mm. It's just doing one thing, recognising it and moving on, you know. Yeah. So,
Deirdre, when approaching perimenopause and menopause, you know, is it advisable to, say, increase your calcium and vitamin D intake? Okay. You know, to reduce the likelihood of osteoporosis.
Well, it depends. I mean, vitamin D is a no-brainer. We live in a bit of a dark tunnel. Anybody who resides on this island could probably do with vitamin D supplementation, particularly during the darker months. So I'm lazy. I think the recommended daily international units is like 400, but I just take a bolus. So on prescription, your GP can give you a once a month prescription for vitamin D. I don't know why that's not over the counter. It absolutely should be. So everybody in my family, I put the pills in the middle of the dining room table, and I'm like, on the first day of every winter month, I'm like, take it, take it, take it, you know. So that's easy.
Yeah.
Calcium's different. Ideally, calcium should be sourced from food if you can possibly do so. This is assuming you're not on a calcium-using medicine.
Yeah.
So someone who's already got, say, osteoporosis and is using a bisphosphonate or Prolia or something should absolutely be on pharmaceutical calcium supplements. Mm. But for the most of us, if you're eating calcium-rich foods like dairy and stuff, absolutely no problem. You don't need supplementation. There are people who are kind of quite, they're either sensitive to a food group or they just don't like it. A lot of people are lactose sensitive and so maybe would avoid sources of calcium by choice. And if that's the case, then maybe they should look to taking a very, very low dose, like a multivitamin with calcium, like something you can source in Lidl or Aldi, by the way. None of these menopause vitamin overpriced. It's the same. Vitamins are vitamins. Get the cheapest ones you can get.
Yeah. Mary, if someone's living with arthritis and has been recommended to take HRT, how does this interact with medications such as NSAIDs, DMARDs, biologics? You know, does it affect its effectiveness or efficacy in any way? Or do we even know?
Well, there's, as we said, there's still a lot of research to be done out there on all of this. The one thing I find is that a lot of patients don't actually, when we're reconciling their medication list when they attend clinic, they often don't put down that they're on HRT. They don't see it as a medicine. Especially if they're not ingesting it, if it's a gel or if it's a pessary or if it's a patch, they don't see it. They
probably see it
as a vitamin or in that category.
That's a good point.
So I'm a big believer in asking about it. And, you know, some people then will say, oh, yeah, I'm on the patch or whatever. And then I'd say, and what about, oh, no, I don't take progesterone. And then I say, oh, please tell me you have no womb or a uterus because you should be on a progesterone. So it opens up a conversation piece about something that they actually don't seem to share with their health professionals when they're on their visit. So I would suggest that people always put it on their medications list.
Everything you're taking.
Everything.
We always encourage people, but it
So looking at the NSAID side of thing, or the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, I suppose we use these with caution because of the risk on cardiovascular health.
Yeah.
So I would always say simple analgesia is probably the route to go initially, but you should never be on NSAIDs without having interaction with your primary care physician or your specialist if you're under specialist care. When it comes to drug-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs and our biologics, there is nothing to suggest that they interfere. In fact, I would say if you're menopausal and you're not managing it, it's probably contributing. And there's lots of data trying to gather data on this, but it would definitely, I think, contribute to your arthritis not being controlled, possibly. And it's one of the questions that I'm wanting to have populated more in our specialists between primary care and between our rheumatology specialists, is that they consider this when they've got a patient in front of them that's in that cohort of menopause or perimenopause, and everything in front of them from clinical exam doesn't suggest that their arthritis is flaring, but yet their symptoms are suggestive and their bloods are not suggestive, and that maybe instead of switching the drug that has served them well over many years, that they would maybe look, if the patient is having symptoms suggestive of menopause or perimenopause, that they would look at maybe a trial period of HRT before they would change the biologic or DMARD drug. So it's just that topic of conversation, you know, and if your physician or your clinician or doesn't bring it up, just say to them, you know, ask them, could this be contributing? This is how I feel, you know, and there's where the conversation lies. It's about talking.
That's an absolutely valid point. We see that all the time because we predominantly see people with underlying conditions. It's very hard for us to pick out how much of this is poorly controlled underlying condition. Which of your symptoms are your menopause, and which of your symptoms are your other morbidity or comorbidity, whatever it happens to be. But I agree, it would be awful to upset the apple cart for someone who's been really well with their arthritic condition just because there's been a new onset of worsening symptoms or new symptoms. And if you don't think menopause, perimenopause, and I would say for anybody over 40, consider it, you know. And the weird thing about perimenopause in the younger cohort is the symptoms can be episodic. So you can have months, weeks during which your pain is much worse, your sleep is upturned, and then you'll get a spontaneous recovery and you'll think, well, I must have been having a flare or whatever. No, that can be perimenopause. It comes and it goes. But that doesn't mean a trial of some kind of hormone stabilizing therapy wouldn't be valid, because usually you'll know very quickly, as soon as you start a little bit of estrogen progestogen supplementation, whether or not it's going to make a difference.
I mean, when it comes to HRT, Deirdre, it does seem that it's being prescribed more
good,
certainly in Ireland, than previously. Certainly a lot more discussion and conversation about it. You know, what alternatives to HRT are recommended and have been shown to be?
Well, You know, it's so funny. I had a conversation about this recently with people in the pharmaceutical industry, and they were saying, well, obviously there's a huge amount of people who can't take HRT. And I'm like, really? Who are they? Mm. And he started making lists, and I'm like, no, we give them HRT. Mm. Oh, but people who've had an angina, no, we give them HRT. Mm. What about people who've had a stroke or had a blood clot? No, we give them HRT. Mm. So, like, it depends on who you're talking to. Mm. For the most part, HRT is suitable for almost everybody.
So how has that evolved over the years? Because there certainly was... Yes.
Because
I'm not sure when, maybe 20, 30 sure. years ago, there was sort of a,
yeah,
there was that, a lot of scaremongering.
That's really
about
important
the use of
to
HRT.
Discuss because there HRT is too broad of a term. Okay, so any form of estrogen, progestogen, maybe testosterone therapy is considered to be HRT. But the majority of the products available to people in the world up until about 20 years ago were derived from the urine of pregnant horses. It was a kind of a cocktail of several different types of estrogen molecule, all of them equine, all of them horse molecules, which you took orally in fairly powerful doses. And most of the data and information that we publish and read about when they say HRT does this, HRT does that, say to lupus or to arthritis or RA or whatever, it's based on those products. Mm. We don't use those products anymore. And if you're out there prescribing them, please stop doing that ASAP. Mm. We use single molecularly identical estradiol E2 through a patch, through a gel, through a spray, so as to completely reproduce the activity of ovarian, human ovarian estrogen. Mm-hmm. So your mom's HRT and my HRT are not the same HRT, and it's chalk and cheese. It genuinely is. Yeah. Moreover, the old products from 20 years ago, the most common progestogen that was given to balance out the impact of the estrogen on the womb, like Mary was talking about, which is essential if you're going to use estrogen, was Provera. That's medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is a very pharmacologically powerful artificial progestogen. We don't use that anymore. Mm-hmm. And typically we use something like natural ovarian micronized progesterone tablets, or we might use a little dihydrogesterone, or we might use some norethisterone in a patch. But gentler, kinder, more clean molecules of HRT. So we see all the benefits with very few of the risks. And that's why we do regularly prescribe after consideration and discussion for people with blood clot disorder, for people with cardiovascular disease and ischemic heart disease, and really without hesitation for people with arthritic conditions, so long as their underlying disease is as well maintained as it can possibly be. So as long as they're aware of modifiables in their lifestyle and doing the best they can, that's all we can ask for. And then we generally start with very low dose non-oral estrogen products because we know they tend to be more benign.
And just, I mean, my final question really would be to both of you. Do you have any, you know, final top tips for those who may be struggling with menopause and their arthritis at this moment?
I'm just going to come in with that, just to be aware as well that we're meeting an awful higher population of women who are having their babies later in life. So they may just have a baby and then all of a sudden they could be entering perimenopause with a young child. And it's about having knowledge about symptoms and being aware of them and talking about them to your primary care physician and your specialist. So that's just a nugget of information just to put out there, not to be afraid to have those conversations, especially when you're in that early throes of having a young baby. So I was trying to come up with something to try and have something that people could remember things to reflect on. So I came up with the word pause, seeing as it's there, and I put some little sentences with it. Just so I'm saying P is for to protect yourself through medication management and making sure that you have regular checkups. A is for active. So stay active, do some form of exercise and stay hydrated. So with exercise goes hydration. They both go hand in hand. And I suppose I'm using U is to do with being upbeat, because mood is impacted on. Mm. And if your arthritis is in a flare, if you're in menopause and it's not being addressed, mood is a huge issue. So trying to manage your stress levels and trying to manage your conditions and speak to somebody if you're feeling unwell. And this term brain fog and anxiety, they're very hard to describe, but they're horrible sensations to be trying to explain to yourself. Mm. So throw them out there. to your primary care physician. Throw them out there to your specialist and have a chat about it. Sleep then, S is for sleep. So improving your sleep. Obviously, we know in general health, if we have a good night's sleep and we wake up refreshed, our day is better before we get out of the bed. That's and to me, if you have good sleep, it leads to a desire to exercise, to go for a walk. And that walk means that you might prevent that issue with obesity and the visceral fat and all the bits that go around that side of it. So sleep has an impact on an awful lot in your day. And then E is for eat well, the balanced diet to keep the weight down and, you know, try and keep your refined sugars to a minimum. As I say, you know, we're here to live a long time and have a good time. So I think we should, like, a little bit of things we like is okay. But if you're living 80% of your week well, like 20% of your week is, you know, you're allowed to have downtime and eat something you like, you know. So that's my thoughts.
Really helpful. Yeah. Thank
that's
you for
really
that.
Good. That's fantastic.
From my point of view, I think you have to obviously be kind to yourself, but you also have to advocate for yourself. I mean, in my experience, I've met patients. We see about 1,000 ladies a year on average in Hollis Street. Not me personally, but my group, you know. And some of them have been referred in from excellent primary care physicians who really know exactly what they need and what to do. But because the guidelines recommend they come through a specialist service first, they're just doing the right thing. And I think, oh, great. Then we meet other women whose referring doctor really seems to be struggling with concepts, and we're there to support them as much as we are the patients themselves. And then the saddest group, and these are the people I want to reach out to now, are the people whose GPs don't even know that there are 6 specialty menopause clinics around the country who don't know what menopause is. I met a woman recently who said her doctor doesn't believe in menopause. He thinks it's a made-up term. You know, now how do you deal with an individual like that? What do you do? Maybe you have a medical card and you live in Baligo somewhere else and you don't have access to alternative primary care advice without considerable expense and travel. You know, it is really difficult. So there are wonderful websites, and I would imagine the arthritis site would be probably a good place to start to sort of help yourself. A lot of people can get menopausal consultations online over the phone. That is available, but usually at a considerable cost. But I'm a huge champion for the family planning and well woman clinics because I'm good friends with the directors of both of those concerns. And if you're in an area where you think you could do better when it comes to menopause advice, and maybe you're not online or you don't have an email address or whatever, just make a phone call. Make a phone call to your local well woman clinic, family planning service. Ask for a senior member of staff. I'm sorry to be prejudiced, but like it really helps if you are over 40 to be a little bit more empathetic when it comes to menopause and perimenopause than when you're, you know, 27. And just say, I'd like to do a phone. Is there a possibility of arranging a phone consultation? I have SLE or I have rheumatoid and I think I may be going through perimenopause or menopause, but I just don't seem to be able to get good advice in my area.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you so much. Deirdre Lundy, Mary Gillespie, thank you so much for joining us today on this important topic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or as they always say, wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.